And this is February the 4th, 1954. I want to give you a very simple talk this morning. It isn't about anything in particular you don't know, but it might have to do with a lot of things you haven't considered. The thing about communication, C to E, and a line, it should tell you immediately that space is the common denominator to all communication. And an individual who has such a thirst for mass and density that he is trying to close in density to him is, of course, going to run out of space, so he's going to run out of communication. Now, you see why surfeiting the appetite of the individual in terms of mass and density, matter, is necessary if you're going to run through havingness to shorten up and straighten out this fellow's communication lines. As long as he has a tremendous thirst for havingness, or is trying to block off a lot of havingness and so on, he is, to some degree or another, shortening space. This should then give you the reason why we probably should try to remedy havingness. Remedying havingness, of course, is an old technique. It's SOP3. The way we're doing it, however, is considerably advanced. But we're still doing the same thing. We're remedying the scarcities. Now, there's only one important thing about havingness. I don't care what the item is, so long as it is dense and massive. That's what you want to aim for. Now, some of you probably still make the mistake of thinking you can remedy bodies, you know, remedy havingness in terms of bodies, or remedying havingness in terms of pebbles or something. Can't do it. You'll have to remedy it in terms of planets and masses. Masses, big masses. You want to get into masses and densities as fast as possible. And the more bodies you run in, the more significance you're going to have. Now, there's two factors involved in havingness, and two factors involved in it concerning communication, which should be quite obvious to you. And one of these is that the individual does have a tremendous thirst for mist. He does have a tremendous thirst for it. He does want the mist universe. This is unmistakable. But this will run on a reverse vector, and he will say that he despises and hates the mist universe. Well, can't you see that his effort to contact and have part of the mist universe brings about, every time he can't have the mist universe, a covert communication system known as eating, economics, all kinds of things. His effort to have the mist universe has gotten so detached and so far away from the actuality that he goes through eating, economics, social structures of one kind or another, and so on. Well, what's driving him off? Actually, what's driving him off? Other life forms. It's his own universe, in each case, because of automaticities and so forth. We won't examine this any further. Other life forms, however, and the individual have engaged in a sort of a war to see who gets the mist universe. And this is the battle involved. Therefore, the favorite trick of other life forms, particularly of his own species, is to yank his attention off the mist universe onto themselves or onto life itself. And so we get the individual with a tremendous amount of life energy and darn little mist. Unapplied life energy, which he's sort of holding in a savings account or something of the sort. This is facsimiles and all sorts of things. He just wants to save mass in case sometimes he wants to animate a planet all at once or something. Weird ideas he gets with regard to this. But just in terms of attention, his attention for mist is continually being snapped onto other life forms. The only thing that is, quote, edible about these other life forms is, of course, their mist. So we have this tremendously covert line finally forming up. where every time an individual tries to grab hold of some mess, some other life form pulls his attention off the material universe. You can run this if you want to do a laborious job on it, which is not good therapy, but it's good investigatory therapy. Have a person put his attention on the floor and then shift his attention to his own level and then up. And put his attention on the floor and shift his attention to his own level and then up. And then get the idea that somebody else is out there putting his attention on his... have him put his attention on the floor and then have that somebody else lifts his attention to his own level and up. And the next thing you know, your boy is getting into re-stimulation all of his early material, whereby his attention was yanked off mist. Now, if you watch a little kid around, a little kid in a fine state of degradation and forgetfulness and wipeout and so forth, he tries to start in fresh all over again. He goes out and he's just as happy about mess. He gets his face dirty and he gets his hands full of it. And any kind of mess, it doesn't matter what kind, he's just happy and cheerful about it. He goes on. Now some other little kid comes along, tries to take it away from him. This is the silliest thing in the world. You know, this little kid who has got his hands on this mess is not at any moment going to absorb and take up all the mess there is. But you'd think so if you watched another kid or watched some parents. They've got to get his attention off of that mess, that's all. And they've got to lift his attention up onto something else, usually that he shouldn't touch. Now, a child doesn't differentiate in terms of messed form. He doesn't care anything about the form it's in particularly, as long as it's just messed, that's all. And he just soon breaks something as not, merely because he doesn't care about the form. He rather instinctively feels he can put any of this stuff into any form he wants to anyhow, so he doesn't have to preserve the form. What he wants is messed. All right. He starts in then with solid matter. That's what attracts his attention, mainly, rather than space. His attention is never attracted by space, because there's no obvious barrier there. So he gets into a hectic state of trying to contact solid matter, because everybody pulls his attention off of it all the time. The next thing you know, he's holding in reserve, or he's going to someday contact the solid matter. But in the meantime, he's got to somehow or other handle or do away with the other life forms which are distracting him. And so he gets deeper and deeper in be prepared, you see. Preparation is the echo of this. What preparation really starts in as is let's find some method to hold this in check and prepare some kind of a barrier or barricade to hold these people off so that I can contact this mess and be left alone. And he gets this finally into be prepared in life. If he studies hard enough, or if he does something or other, he works hard enough, someday he will be permitted to what? To touch matter. If he can just do away with, or get important enough, or be powerful enough in the face of other life entities that are around, or units, then eventually he will be permitted to touch matter. That's his goal. It's a lost goal. Matter, of course, is only one part of the component parts of the messed universe. These component parts, of course, matter and energy and space, and then in their motion and combination, time. All of these things are barriers of one kind or another. But the material of which the barrier called matter is made is something of which a Thetan is very fond. He loves this stuff. Now, it causes him to close space. There's much more space in this universe than there is matter. As a matter of fact, there's practically no matter in this universe at all. And he's trying to avoid these spaces and contact something in the spaces. His direction is always toward somethingness then, and not toward nothingness. So he begins to close distances, and distance is the common denominator of all communication. So a process by this, a straight wire process, a very good one, is indicated. Give me some distances you are not trying to close. Give me some distances you're not trying to open. It will turn on some very juicy somatics, by the way. some distances you're not trying to close, some distances you're not trying to open. You see how that echoes against time, the particle time processing that I gave you some time ago. Two particles you're not trying to move apart, or that you don't object to being together, and two particles that are apart that you don't object to having apart. And this will unlock the fellow from many places on the time track. Well, if there is this hunger for matter, and demonstrably there is, and if the closure of space is such that it brings about an aberrated condition in the individual, since it stacks all of his engrams and his time track and everything else up, why, certainly we'd better enter the problem somewhere to answer up to some degree to the desires and appetites of our Thetan, so that he will thereafter be willing to open up some space. That's rather easy to do. If you start an avalanche on the individual, and you've got this avalanche running good and strong, and you have him get up there and, you know, put some more into the avalanche, and then finally get so he runs the avalanche himself. By the way, if you start an avalanche and don't have the individual add to it and then take it under his own control and start it himself, you know, and keep it going, why, you won't take over the automatic machine, because nearly all of his automatic machinery is trying to knock apart things which are liable to take things from him and to give him things which are massive and dense. And all of this machinery is categorized into mocking machinery and unmocking machinery, but nevertheless, the slant on the machinery is to give him something. Well, the messed universe aids and abets this like mad, because it flows in on him from 360 degrees. And therefore, if you look in the first book, you will find where it says a river which is running in the same direction the engineer wants it to run, gives you an example of how you can ease an aberration into an individual. You see, he wants the aberration, and if it happens that all other forces parallel the direction of his desire, why, oh boy, we've got real strong stuff there. Well, the messed universe directly parallels the direction of desire with its inflow. Individual wants this stuff. Well, now it could be that the messed universe, just by inflowing, has created an artificial appetite. Well, that's theoretical, but as we test the preclear, we find out that preclears do want this stuff. They do. And they say they don't. And they say they want to get away from it and so forth. Well, now, what is this eatingness? As we get down into the early bank, we find that lichens and moss prepare mast in some fashion, and lichens and moss are then prepare the ground and leave a deposit in the ground which other grasses can then take over, you see, having eaten what has been eaten, and then that some other animals or insects or something of the sort can eat from the second stage of grasses, and then other animals eat from those animals, and we get on up the line, and when you eat a cow, you are running a very covert communication line. It's a very indirect communication line in terms of eatingness. Now, remember what I told you about the preclear being a big mass of telephone cable and so forth that's going in all directions and pervades all sorts of things, and he is trying desperately to get from C to E. He is at C, and he's trying to make the body E and have one straight line. Now, if he has one straight line, all right. But instead of that, every command he puts into the bank enters this coil of communication wire at strange and mysterious places and restimulates all sorts of C's and E's, and pretty soon he doesn't know what the hell he's doing. He gets to be normal after a while. And any command he gives himself shoots around the curves and jumps under and over and re-stimulates new C's and new E's and new overts and motivators and all the other mechanisms of facsimiles and so forth, as we know them, go into re-stimulation. Why do they go into re-stimulation? It's because the individual is trying to get from his place, C, to E. He finally loses his place at C. And after he's lost his place at C, then anything can be cause. Now, practically any individual that sits down in your auditing chair has lost his place at sea. You tell him be 3 feet back of his head, and you immediately give him the semblance of a straight communication line. He has located himself, and now he knows where the body is, and he can give direct orders to the body, and you've simply bypassed all of his lines. Exteriorization, interiorization, just by straightening out communication lines, then does a great deal for the case. Now, where the individual, however, has done something else, where the individual has bogged himself into C's and E's, any thought he thinks gives him a super tangle of communication lines so that any thought he thinks seems to have significance. And therefore he starts looking for causes. Well, he's the only cause there can be in that bank. The rest is just a bunch of bypass lines. So your individual sinks deeper and deeper into economics and the problems of eatingness and the worries of life and his responsibility to other life forms and gets further and further from his initial desire, which is to contact MEST. He's now not contacting MEST, he's contacting bodies. You see, and a body is covertly attached to MEST. It has a tremendous, continuous communication line. The body's got one that goes to some work area. And then the work area restimulates a paycheck, and the paycheck restimulates the grocery store, and the grocery store restimulates the butcher shop, and the butcher shop, the slaughterhouse, and the slaughterhouse, the cattle ranch, and the cattle ranch, the cattle, and the cattle, the grass, the lichens, and the moss, and we finally get to MEST. Oh, what a lousy communication line. That's terrible. All your thetan's trying to do is reach MEST. Well, if an individual simply could hang on to the back corners of a room long enough, he'd blow clear. Obviously, because you're stretching a straight communication line of mesh. You've got two communication lines up there, and he's getting these two pieces of mesh, the two corners of the room. Now, that tells you why this is a stretch, straight communication line. That's all there is to it. When you have a pre-clear who is hard to exteriorize and who is not seeing and is not perceiving, when he has black clouds around him, white clouds, it doesn't matter. He simply has an indirect communication line. That's all. And his communication line is so indirect that he can't find any C for him to be at, so he doesn't know where he is. Well, there's another process than holding the back corners of the room, which answers up to the same thing, and that is you just have the fellow right where he is, kind of paw at any actual native, not remanufactured, but actual native mist. You know, just earth. You have him find a patch of earth and paw at it. Well, he's in his head, you see, or he's someplace, and we just have him reach out and paw at this earth and get interested in it. Don't care whether he finds it in front of him or in back of him or side of him. And when I say paw at it, I mean just that. You know, and feel it. And fool with it and feel it and paw at it and so forth. And not think about anything else, just paw at it. It's quite remarkable and very interesting what happens to a prickler when you do this. He immediately gets himself into a much better condition of rendition, communication, so forth. Well, you put some distance there, you see. You put some distance in his communication line, and you've certainly strung one line. Your object is to string one line. Why, let's string one line and just have him paw some mist. Interesting process. All kinds of other lines, of course, try to close in and open up and go out and pop and snap and all sorts of significances occur. A lot of havingness may blow off that he really feels is quite desirable. But the truth of the matter is the havingness he wants is not a mock-up of the havingness. It's actual stuff. You know, gravel, sand. No more of that. Now, somebody came up to me rather starry-eyed right after the Congress and said a lot of people are getting well by going into a radium mine up here someplace, an uranium mine. So on. If they knew about this process, they would know very well why people would get well. But if the second they attribute it to some kind of a radiation from the radium, they're off the beam. If they were to take an individual who is in foul condition and, unbeknownst to this individual, simply hang up bags of radium around his room, you know, back of the walls and that sort of thing, this individual never would get well. Hadn't anything to do with radiation beyond this, that that's awful dense stuff. Now, however, the individual taking himself up to a uranium mine knows it's a uranium mine, wants to contact the uranium, goes into a cave where he is entirely surrounded by matter, much of which is quite dense, and he knows this and slurp, slurp, slurp. Now, how much more effective this would be if the individual went into the cave. You see, if you just had a bag of radium, it just wouldn't work anywhere near as well as putting the fellow in the cave. Now, we have him be in the middle of this cave, and let's have him paw uranium. You know, reach out and pet it. That's all. You'd find people getting well at a fantastic rate of speed. Not because of radiation. Now, every once in a while, you'll find an individual all hung up at some period when he was bombarded with X-rays. It's quite common to find an individual stuck on the time track during an X-ray picture-taking process. You know, somebody takes an X-ray of him, and we find him hung up on the track. Almost anybody who's had a lot of X-rays taken of them will flip on an E-meter if you say, don't breathe, don't move. That's what they say to him on an X-ray, don't breathe, don't move. And they say, all right. Thing goes whir, click, and they say, all right. That's nice stuff. You know, X-rays, slurp, slurp. And a darn small dose of it, however. Tiny little amount of it, so it's awfully scarce, you see. Another thing, an individual can be found glued in front of many television tubes if he's a television fan. Because there's heavy X-rays come through those television tubes. There's heavy matter, actually, and those rays comes through those screens. Anybody sitting in front of a television screen is under a continuous bombardment of heavy particles, radioactive particles. The television industry doesn't let this out very carefully. They have never solved the problem of shielding. Over at Philco one day, a fellow was asked, just on the supposition that there were heavy particles. He was in the television tube design department, and he was asked very forthrightly, Now, what are you going to do about the heavy particles that are bombarding the audiences in front of these screens? Well, we're doing all we can. We've tried some leaded screens, but that doesn't work. But some of these days, why, we'll come up with something that does work and stop it. Took his finger off his number, didn't he? You put a Geiger counter in front of a TV tube, and it'll go tickety-tick, 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 tickety-tick. Very interesting. Harmful? It'll kill you. The body can't take it. Now, television is writing a very, very, very dangerous little point right there, because if the public at large were to connect the bombardment of television with the deadliness of the atom bomb rays, they would not let their kids sit in front of it. Actually, it hangs anybody up on the track. It's the most wonderful advertising mechanism in the world because it sticks the preclear in every ad. And that's about the way it works. You run somebody who customarily watches television, you'll find him stuck in front of TV screens. Now, there's another reason for this. Movie screens stick people, too, but not because of particles. It's because the movie screen keeps telling them to go elsewhere and be elsewhere, and they have to keep holding themselves in the chair and hold themselves in their head to keep on looking at the screen to go elsewhere. So an individual who has watched an enormous amount of entertainment has gotten to the point of where when you say go elsewhere, like a picture says to him go elsewhere, he just fixes himself a little tighter in his head. Entertainment, the fictional part of this universe. The more important thing about the motion pictures, though, is that it does not deliver to the individual any mass. It's totally light particles, and there's no mass involved in the presentation. And if we look over live entertainment audiences, if we could examine a live entertainment audience and a motion picture entertainment audience, the live stage audience not having seen pictures, you see, and the picture audience not having seen stage, we could select out two groups of this character, and possibly we could around New York. I know people in New York who've never been to the movies for 15 years, they wouldn't go near them. We'd find that there's probably a considerable difference in their attitude toward entertainment. And we'd probably find that there was a considerable difference in their exteriorization potential. Probably find the people who had watched live stage were much easier to exteriorize than those who had constantly watched movies. This is a problem of mass. The live stage does give you some mass. The actors have mass, at least. See, it's not a problem then of a very strange problem. It's just a problem of masking. Now, another thing that the live stage gives you is some space. You have depth and space. Now, one of the strangest things that you're going to have to process one of these days is going to be 3D. Because there is depth with no mass, and that's impossible. And audiences don't like 3D. I don't care what they put on in 3D. Any popular picture of yesterday, had it been put on with 3D, would have been less popular. You take this little picture, Kiss Me, Kate. It happens to have been run and printed so as to be shown on a flat screen as well as a 3D screen. And the Kiss Me, Kate is massing as much or a little more box office as a perfectly flat picture than as 3D. People want to go to see Kiss Me, Kate, and they'll even see it if it's 3D. But other pictures, which are not quite up to that par, people are going around swearing at right now. They're having an awful time with these pictures. And yet, really, there's nothing wrong with 3D. It's no great strain on the eyes or anything of the sort. It's just the fact that it's this damn delusion. They apparently have mass there, and there's no mass there. And they want mass, and they don't see the mass, and so the picture dissatisfies them. This stuff becomes very elementary when you apply Scientology to the business of livingness. You could tell immediately that your best method of advertising, of course, would be TV. It would not be radio because people don't have good sonic recall. Furthermore, if you wanted to build up a long-term program, you would catch the kids. And you would just keep them coming through. You'd lay in basic on them. If you wanted to start organizing a country right now on a slave state basis, you would organize it via TV. Most wonderful thing there in the way George Orwell, in his 1984, paralleled and probably took from early electronic societies. And these, of course, specialize in such things as TV, which can be heavy wave bombardment. All right. So much for that. You're pretty clear, then. He's trying to weave a straight communication line and has lots of illusions and things and stuff around him which are preventing him from doing this. And one of the main things that preventing him from doing it, of course, is his slavery to an economic system. He keeps fighting this system. And the whole theory is that he can have some money if he invests some effort. And if he has the money, he can then have some mess. I wish you'd show me the police force that is making it necessary for him to have money in order to have messed. Now, there is, if he wants manufactured or reprocessed messed, yes, the economic system does step in there as a necessity, in other words, heavy messed. But we look at the happy gayness of a child, and we find out that the child doesn't give a damn for the form, so this too must have an artificiality about it. Therefore, the thirst of the preclear, or the Thetan, is for mest, and he is buying it at heavy cost. He is buying it at such a cost that he doesn't obtain it, because each one of these economic systems depends that he become more and more dependent for his acquisition of mest upon the system itself, and a new dependency is introduced, which introduces, much more important to us, brand new artificial C's to E's in his bank. You know, more communication lines of more kinds, and more and more kinds, and more and more kinds, and more and more kinds. A writer, a painter, and so forth, who is trying to gain his daily bread by this, has entered his artistic creativeness into the field of economics and as such is liable to suffer considerably in terms of his happiness and cheerfulness. It's almost impossible to maintain any continuous, arduous contact with the economic world and at the same time retain one's creative ability in terms of form, because the economic system continually presents the individual with already created forms. So we have our form as a secondary consideration, and the actual fact of messed particles themselves being a primary consideration to the individual. Therefore, the remedy of havingness is a very necessary step in the recovery of an individual. But primarily, because we say communication is more important than affinity, it is more important than a reality, and we say that the plainest form of communication has the common denominator of space in it and has cause to effect as its motive, we can get this kind of a situation with the individual. We can get a thetan contacting messed. This, of course, to some degree makes him an effect. You understand that we're putting, when we string this straight line, making him pause a matter, we're putting the C in the matter and the E at the thetan. Now, in order to get this situation reversed, the thetan tries to change or alter the matter. And so we actually have a conversation between the thetan and the matter. That's what's going on. Now, to make a conversation out of it, the thetan feels the matter. That makes him cause of the contact, but then the matter creates an effect upon him. Therefore, he must put out some imagination toward the matter to keep a two-way system, communication system, going with matter. But imagination toward the matter is necessary. That's a big mystery, this stuff called matter. Who put it there and so forth? We realize this is a big mystery. Well, it's not a particularly important mystery, because it's there. Now, it is there. But as he drifts away from it, economically, via eatingness, so forth, as he drifts away from it, it becomes less and less real. It becomes more and more illusory. Now, just on the other side, there it is, and before it deteriorates in terms of more communication systems to obtain it, there is another creative contact of the material to which the thetan is a partner. In other words, he has to create it, and then he can feel it. Well, to get him up to the point of where the creation was, or where the creation takes place, why, you better put him in good contact with it. So your remedy is havingness, your remedy is communication. When you're remedying his havingness, remember, your remedy is communication. And communication has to have space in it. And an individual to be free has to have space. Restriction is the stuff that of which slaves are made. So restriction and lack of space are right next door to each other. Well, same thing. Restriction and failure of communication are the same thing. Okay, now just for a little demonstration of this, let's just try it. Let's just try it. Now close your eyes. You'll find somewhere outside the window or the yard or the street or something of the sort, you'll find some raw matter. I'm not talking about pavement now or grass. We want some sand or gravel. Down underneath the floor, there's a lot of unprocessed sand or gravel. So let's just directly contact this sand or gravel and paw it wherever you find it. Just pet it. And just continue to do so now. Examine it, pet it. Now, let's just pat it now. Direct contact. Let's just pet it. Touch it. And see if we can't feel it to a little depth. Now let's feel a little bigger area of it. And get the particles more particularly. A little greater depth of it. And see, we can't quite get the flavor of it. Constituency and the flavor of it. Okay, now. Okay, end of that. What happened?
I was coming to the grains varied a lot. They were smoother as they were bigger, like gravel. But as you got very small, they became terrifically hard and very, very sharp, just like glass. And some were almost like glass, yellow glass, little tiny grains. And they seemed to be so compact, you know. And there were various colours, yellow and black. Almost
white stuff. Mm-hmm.
I was more interested in the sand than I was in the pebbles.
A lot of locks fly through as you did this.
Mm-hmm.
Very hungry.
Oh, I like it.
Yeah, hunger.
I like the feeling. It was a comforting feeling. I got something. Sand is too splendid
to be sad. That's right. That's right. Now you get up there and get around some of these super dense stars. There are a lot of stars up there that are so dense they can't radiate. There's something vastly wrong with the periodic chart because it just doesn't allow for enough different kinds of electrons and enough variances and variabilities, and it certainly doesn't even vaguely allow for enough mass and density. It stops way short. For instance, the companion star of Sirius, one spoonful of it on Earth would weigh 1 ton. Well, what kind of matter would that be? I brought this up one time to a physicist, a nuclear physicist, a friend of mine, and I said, well, now, that's a very interesting thing, and what kind of matter do you suppose that is? How many electrons per... And so forth, and he said, oh, well, you can't consider it in that light. And I said, what? I said, don't you count the electrons that go round and round the protons and so forth? Well, yes, but after stuff gets up to the density of plutonium and so forth, it becomes above the level of tolerance and, of course, explodes. And I said, well, now, how do you account for the fact that that star up there, that binary small companion there, weighs about that? It's accounted for in that fashion. Well, I don't know that the astronomers are right about that thing. And I said, well, let's take the size of Sirius and take the speed with which that little star goes around it, and we find to be that close in, boy, this thing would have to be awfully dense, and we calculate it out, and it's very obvious that it is that dense. Well, that's according to astronomy, and we wouldn't know about that. He wouldn't know. The immediate conclusion that plutonium explodes just because of its density shouldn't lead to the immediate conclusion that everything which is that dense explodes. And that's an unreasonable assumption, by the way. You say everything that is dense as a firecracker explodes. That's not a reasonable assumption either, because cigarette lighters are more dense than firecrackers, and cigarette lighters don't explode very often. And in such a way, there's very little known, actually, in the textbooks concerning the constituency of matter. But anyway, did you get a little jump on this, a little build up? Yes, Lee. Mm-hmm. That's all right. That's all right. If a preclear could turn that on, it would. It's starting that avalanche. Hunger. Well, that's basically what hunger is. Is a hunger for mess. It isn't a hunger for rats or a hunger for ice cream sodas or something of the sort. Here you have these strange and peculiar flavors. Now, it's odd that the body has such a variation in hunger. But you shouldn't take something as aberrated with as many cockeyed communication lines as a body as your criteria in what is satisfying or not satisfying in mess. The body has many prohibitions and so forth. Take ascorbic acid. It must be so many atoms and molecules of various kinds and hydrocarbons and et cetera strung together in so many directions, and we get this together, and the body finds its hunger is satisfied in the teeth area and so on by ascorbic acid. Well, that's interesting, but the thetan doesn't have any such anatomy to support. And the thetan doesn't have a delicate stomach. There's no reason why he should be supposed to have a delicate stomach. But because he's in association with the body, he becomes very, very choosy indeed about what kind of mess he can have. As a consequence, he will borrow the aberration that he can't have hard messed, which is directly opposed to what he wants. He wants hard messed. Now, this little automaticity there that I was showing you yesterday concerning you look around and knock every dense mass you can see into a softness and a glueiness or a softness of some sort. Knock them soft. That is the automatic machine of the stomach. It doesn't work there. It has to soften everything up. The saliva glands, they have to soften everything up. The goal of the stomach and the goal of the body is to soften it all up. And yet a body is very happy about armor plate, you know, to protect it. And yet it has to soften everything up. Now, a body goal to soften everything up, of course, will cause the thetan to start softening everything up, and that isn't what the thetan wants. Quite remarkable. A fellow one told me one time, I don't know why I've been doing this, but for the last week or so, I've been chewing on a heavy piece of energy mass that was up in front of my face. And I've been chewing on this and chewing on it and chewing on it, and I finally got it all softened up, and I just got it softened up when I suddenly realized that way early on the track, I had looked for a long, long time to find a piece of matter that heavy. In other words, he'd been saving this for years and years and years and years and years, and then one day he all of a sudden up and chews it up. Well, that's just because he's borrowed this aberration, got to soften everything up by the body. Well, now, what conclusions can we reach here with regard to this, you might say, pawing processing? Well, it's that an individual is at least contacting the product of his automaticity. I mean, we could at least tentatively assign that if the messed universe is his automaticity. But whichever way, and we might assign his hunger to the fact he's been hit so often by matter that it has developed an artificial hunger in him for it. And we could theorize on it in various ways, but does it make a preclear better? Well, yes, it does, but after you've done just so much of that and so forth, you better go back to fulfilling his havingness in terms of an automatic avalanche. In other words, this doesn't bypass having to resolve his havingness in terms of large, dense masses. Should be very clear to you. It's an awfully good way to bring an individual up the line. All right, just as a very fast review, what process you're doing this week. You're taking an individual in or out. You're working around on acceptance level to find out something he can have by gradient scales or the dynamics or some other fashion, any fashion you can, build it up to the point where he can have very dense masses, and you get these masses to avalanche on him, and then get him to supplement the avalanche with other masses he's throwing into it, and then finally we have him take over and turn on an avalanche of his own on himself of dense masses. All right. This is assisted by applying courage particles and enjoyment particles. And somebody comes up this morning with a suggestion that a hunger particle might be quite effective in this, and so it might. But a little bit of courage and then a little bit of enjoyment, a little bit of courage and a little bit of enjoyment produces a very weird catalyst on any such flow, because those are the two entrance points, particularly courage. Courage is the entrance point to resistance, fear, horror, and enjoyment, of course, is the entrance point to pull in. Inflow, desirable inflow. Well, now, process is to get the individual exteriorized and do this if possible. And if not possible, get him exteriorized and do it. We'll just do it. And then get him exteriorized and move him in and out of large, heavy, actual masses. Start in with a large rock here on Earth. Have him go in and out of that rock. Maybe go in and out of it and feeling courageous about it, and go in and out of the rock, you know, outside the rock and inside the rock, feeling that he enjoys it. And then have him own the mass of the rock and from inside, and then own it while he's outside of it. And in other words, just get him interiorized and exteriorized and interiorized and exteriorized and interiorized and exteriorized from this mass, and then repeat this on something like the moon and repeat it on the sun. Sooner or later, of course, repeat it on Earth, having me in Earth and outside of Earth and so forth. And if he begins to boil off, why, we will do something there in terms of havingness. We've just going to assume that we have upset his havingness balance, and so he remedies havingness with more markup, and we probably get a second avalanche. And this way we're going to boost him out. You can do change space processing. You can do anything you want to with a pre-clear after he's well exteriorized. But let's remember to exteriorize and interiorize him from lots of mass. Let's also remember to change his emotions while he's exteriorized, holding one emotion upon the body and feeling several himself. And also have him manufacture the particle called sensation and sexual sensation, other particles. And certainly have him be able to handle the particles of courage and enjoyment. Take that list you have there, clean up the messed universe on him. You know, be the place where he entered the messed universe and be here. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, until he's cleaned up these areas and come up to present time. Exteriorize with some certainty. Don't do it while he's still in the body. Practically kill him. That last one. Change the space while still in the body is dynamite. And after you've remedied his havingness considerably in terms of this and that, why, let's have him reject some things. And, if possible, start an outflow avalanche on him. Have him reject lots of things, and then have him look through matter and at matter. and have him make his own space. You just would go along with the various things we've been talking about with this type of processing. If Case is very resistant, have him waste in brackets. Courage, have him waste in brackets enjoyment. If he's very, very occluded, have him waste and save and accept and desire and be curious about black machines in brackets. Give him a lot of straight wire like you have in 8C. I gave you a couple of interesting ones here today on spaces you're not trying to close and spaces you're not trying to open. Confusions are liable to show up where he's confused one kind of messed with another kind of messed. He's liable to have an asteroid confused with Earth. By the way, Earth was, you know, flat for an awfully long time. Everybody said so. Well, this applies to an asteroid. It'd make a person feel like he wasn't here. He'd know Earth was round. You see, he'd know Earth was spherical. And then somebody would say, well, this place is flat. And the only flat pieces of matter he'd know about would be someplace like the asteroid belt. He might get confused and consider that he was on an asteroid, not on Earth, which would be an unreal and lost geographical misposition. I've run that out of several preclears, by the way. They think they're on another planet. They think they are elsewhere, merely because they have had it laid in very heavily that Earth is flat. You know, they look down through the crust of Earth and they find nothing but emptiness down there. No, it can't be that they're on Earth then, can it? Earth's round. Thetans for 10,000 years have known Earth was round, by the way. Somebody coming along and trying to tell you as a kid that everybody believed the Earth was flat before Columbus certainly doesn't know anything about history. In fact, person must be a school teacher. Fabulous. The Earth was calculated, I think, with an inaccuracy of 1/25. Long before Julius Caesar. And the intelligentsia of Earth had never considered it was flat. And Columbus never proved that it was round. Columbus made the most fantastic navigational error, you know. That's the most fabulous error on record. If the Earth had been the size that Columbus said it was, why, he would have landed in the Indies instead of America. But he had computed the fact that the distance, the width of the Atlantic and Pacific was 2/3 of the width of the Atlantic. That's quite an error when you get down to thinking about it. It's a big factor there. And he never did prove it. It was proved by Magellan. But it wasn't proved by Magellan at all. Prince Henry the Navigator and the rest of the boys, they were going down into past the equator and so forth out of Portugal, had never calculated otherwise than that Earth was round. That's why they could navigate. People were quite customarily shooting the sun and so forth for centuries and centuries and centuries before Magellan did a circumnavigation. What Magellan proved was that somebody could sail around the world, not that the world was round. But this other funny one has drifted along with a lot of balderdash and nonsense straight down the groove and has, oddly enough, been wildly supported by the church. It's been the church that's believed this. Well, the church believed this? What the hell do you mean? They didn't believe this. They weren't that stupid. They must have wanted willfully to mix somebody's geography. About the only thing you could do to really confuse the Thetan was he thinks he's on one place, and then you get him pinned down very nicely, and then you sell him a big sales talk on the fact that the place he's on has a different geometric shape. It's flat. Thetan says, my God, I must be on the asteroid belt. Well, this is all very silly. I thought I was here, and I'm there, but then there must be here. Oh, dear, where am I? And that's really the effect it produces upon your preclear when you run into this. If you have a preclear that looks down through the crust of Earth and finds nothingness, you know, a few feet down and then nothingness. He thinks he's probably on the asteroid belt. There's an excellent way to run this is you take Earth, you have him mock up Earth or get an idea of a sphere of Earth. If he's a black case, he can get a sphere, you know. He can get a black sphere and so forth. You have him get a sphere and make it into a flat thing. Get a sphere and turn it into something flat, and a sphere 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 into something flat. And after a while, this weird one shows up. All of a sudden, why, there's a sort of a spong, ping, and the asteroid belt's in one place, and Earth's here. He's got the two things crossed. There must have been quite an operation going on there, and it might be part of the Between Lives operation. I never inquired very deeply into it. By the way, on the, just a side comment on the Between Lives period and so on. You know, everybody in the Between Lives area is awfully nice to a Thetan. You know that. They don't get rough with them. They are a little bit condemning. Well, you failed again and so forth, but sort of on the basis of we forgive you and for your own good you'd better forget. And everybody's very nice to him. And they turn on his knowingness for a moment and turn it off again, just show him they can. But he quite routinely leaves that area thinking what nice people everybody is. Now, somebody who's getting bunches of purple lights showing up and so forth is probably looking at the gates of Mars. And you do change the space between here, or an operating room, and the gates of Mars, change of space, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, these purple lights will blow. Purple lights. Thetan always has a little amount of mass. He's always packing around some mass. It is visible in ultraviolet light. That's why the gates of Mars are the gates of Mars. There's a lot of mechanics involved in this that we don't have to worry about. There's a terrific amount of technology involved in how you get an individual to report to a Between Lives area, to get re-indoctrinated and to accept your assignment of the body and to know where the bodies are and to get proper assignments out. And they're having an awfully interesting time of it. No doubt about that. We don't have to worry about that. No time has it ever really come up and smacked us in auditing. We got change of space processing, that remedies it, and so do a lot of other things. So, any questions?
I have a young man preacher at home who has nearly all the time that purple.
Yeah, that's the gates of Mars. He's stuck. Oh, such significance as blow out in any type of this process. And you remedy somebody's having this and more darn ridges and ideas and gimmicks and significances and facsimiles and implants start blowing out. Only reason he holds in an implant is he doesn't have enough energy, he thinks.